Hello and welcome to Radio Inqilab, a podcast focused on change makers who are working to educate, resolve, and change the complex systems within which we live. Radio Inqilab aims to bring voices to the forefront who have traditional as well as modern solutions for our planet, can share knowledge on how we take decisive action and live in harmony with each other and Mother Earth. In this time of chaos, disinformation, and negativity, Radio Inqilab seeks to focus on ideas that work and the positive impact they can have. My name is Rupande Mehta, and I come to you from Lenape Land in New Jersey. Today, our guest is Rangine Tehrani. Rangine is a daughter of Mohammed and Anna Azimzadeh Tehrani. Her earliest years were rooted in Tehran, where she lived with her parents and brother during the Iran-Iraq War, an experience that ultimately set the foundation for her commitment to peace and conflict transformation work. Rangine has her BA in Communication Studies from Portland State University and her MA in International Conflict Resolution from the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. Rangine is a circle practitioner, certified professional facilitator, and the principal and founder of Soul Resolutions International. Rangine has received professional honors, including serving as a senior fellow with the American Leadership Forum Mountain Valley Chapter, being named one of Sacramento Business Journal's 40 Under 40, and serving as a fellow with the Institute of International Public Policy from 2003 to 2009. Rangine, welcome to the podcast. It's so lovely to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really, really honored to be here.
Wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about your experiences living in Tehran and then your arrival to the United States.
Yeah, so I maybe on another episode, one day in the future, I'll tell you the story about my parents, because that's really always where I start my own story is sort of where they met and how they met. But I'll kind of Cliff's Notes version is they essentially met in the United States in Portland, Oregon. In the 70s, and my dad was visiting, or he was studying, he was doing his master's degree in Portland, Oregon, when he met my mom there. And so once they got married, they moved back to Iran, and this was post-revolution. So this is an important context for the type of environment that they encountered when they got there. So my mom, being an American, very at that time, unadvised for her to be there, started a family. They started a family, and when my mom was just about to give birth, she actually came to the United States and gave birth to me in Portland, Oregon. So that's where I was born. And then when I was about 3 months old, we moved back to Iran, and that was, or she took us back to Iran, and that was the plan. So I was there with my brother, who was just a little bit older than me by about a year and a half. And so this was, I will date myself at this point, in 1983. And so the Iran-Iraq War was in full effect at that time. And my parents did a really phenomenal job of protecting us and sheltering us from what was happening literally outside our doorstep. And so, we were really young. Like, I was in my first few years of life, right? And so I have often been told that I have more memories than most people expect me to have from being so young while I was there. But there was always a very ominous sort of sense of something going on around us. And so there would be nights where, the bombing would start, and so power would be cut so that targets wouldn't be obvious to, bombs being dropped. And my parents, rather than go into a panic, would just stay very calm. And my mom was so great about, she would light these kerosene lamps, and we would have coloring books, and she would tell us to tell her stories and try to keep us as calm as we could with all of this going on around us. My family was also incredibly privileged because on during some of the times where we knew bombing was going to start, we would be able to leave the city and sort of get a little bit of refuge in some of the outer areas of town. But this knowledge of, like, this sort of incessant, ominous presence of war was always around. And we'd have the armies marching down the streets, and we'd have American videos playing on the television. So those would go on mute, and we would just sort of sit silently in the house waiting for them to pass. So a lot of things that, at that time seemed normal because that's what we had to do. In retrospect, is such a strange reality to think back on now. And my room, served as the bomb shelter. I don't fully still understand the rationale for that because if a bomb dropped on our house, I don't think my room would have saved us, but that was the room we would go into when the bombing would start. And so, anyways, all these little sort of glimmers of life at that time to say, it was a stark reality. It's starkly different reality than what we came to when we came to the United States. And I was in about first grade by the time we left. So this was like late 80s at that point.
Wow, that's quite a load to carry as well over the years. Just those memories and just kind of having to escape the bombs and so forth. I'm sorry about that. I can't even imagine what a young child has to go through. And I'll make this reference just because of the world we're living in right now. What's going on in Gaza, and the kids that are dying every day, or being murdered rather every day. And to think that what they're going through, I guess you must feel a certain sense of a different sense, a higher sense of compassion because of what you have seen yourself. Would that be accurate?
Yes, and I would say that our situation, the type of war that we were experiencing in Iran at that time, is vastly different than what's going on in Gaza at this moment. The sheer and targeted destruction and erasure of a culture is vastly different than what we were experiencing. And so, while there are some through lines of like war is always going to be deeply horrific for any population experiencing it, I think there is a vastly different sort of level of experience that is happening in Gaza than was happening when I was a kid in Iran.
Absolutely. And thank you for drawing that distinction because you are right. There's a systematic erasure going on in Gaza, which thankfully you were not subjected to. So you've had a long arc in terms of sort of having this very early trauma in your life, if I may say, if I may call that, from the war, and then coming back to the United States where you were born, and then getting into some very interesting work. So let's delve a little bit into that. It's a two-part question of how did you sort of get into this work? And I think I know the answer to this, but I'd like you to still sort of touch on it, is why is this important to you?
Yeah, I think I love both of those questions. So it is definitely been a long arc, and I think when I kind of started out and really thinking and shaping my career, my early 20s, and through college and what I wanted to study, I had a different vision of the type of work I wanted to do. And I think life is funny in the ways that it lands you where you really need to be. I always had a really deep love for culture and learning about different cultures and different experiences people were having and coming from. And I sort of envisioned myself, and also obviously peace and justice, right? This is very much rooted in my upbringing. And it was through a very specific conversation with a dear, dear, dear friend of mine that I think it really like this light bulb moment of like, why do I want to go into this? And she was like, well, it seems like your roots, it's connected to your roots. And I was like, it was like the most obvious thing that like I needed to talk through to really bring it into my consciousness. And once it was there, it was just like, oh my gosh, yes, this is so much about like this matters to me because of where I came from. And my original vision for myself was really to move in fully into international relations work, international conflict resolution. This was a trajectory that I was on through graduate school. That was what I got my master's in, was international conflict resolution work, and really envisioned this career where I was really being able to do work, particularly in the Middle East, right, because of my roots in that region. And through a series of events, that happened, including some really incredible mentors that I had along the way. I think there were these seeds that got planted of what it would look like to begin my own business, start my own business, and really get to do this work from a different perspective. And the introduction to the world of facilitation, the introduction to the world of circle practicing and circle practices and healing practices really shifted the trajectory of the work from much from this very international, much more to a very introspective space. And I'd say that's kind of where the shift happened for me. And now I'm sort of really fully living into that introspective space of how do we create the conditions? And I would also say, like, the through line for all of my work is how do we create the conditions to expand our understanding and awareness of ourselves and each other in service to raising collective consciousness? Because right now we are creating, like, all these problems have been created, and the famous Albert Einstein quote of, we cannot solve the problems with the same level of thinking that created them. We have to be able to look at this differently, and we can only do that from a different level of consciousness.
That's so brilliant. I had some thoughts around this as well. And we were chatting earlier before we started the episode about how individual transformation is so essential to change the reality on the ground. Because everywhere we see, we're encountered with a mindset that may not necessarily, like you said, it's the same thinking that has got it us into this place, and how is it going to get us out? So I think that the kind of work that you're doing on an individual level is instrumental if we want to see a changed society. So I really applaud you for that and for taking the risk coming out of grad school. That's a huge endeavor, and I mean, good for you, for kind of going with where your heart said you needed to go and the kind of work that you needed to do. I really totally respect that.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I will say it was about 4 or 5 years after graduate school that I was able to launch my business, and through the support and love of family and friends, and a lot of encouragement, and again, some really incredible mentors who I think really modeled so powerfully what it looked like to be a woman business owner and the possibilities for that of really getting to live into your purpose. I know it's not for everyone, but I've been very, very grateful to be able to do this work in this way for this amount of time.
Wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about that work. So the circle way is a circle methodology which offers a countercultural, equity-centered approach to working with groups while shifting organizations from transactional places into relational spaces. What does this mean?
Yeah, so I came across the Circle Way in 2017 and have been, it was sort of like this thing that I've been searching for and searching for, and then finally found it. It sort of like brought all of these different worlds and sort of sense of how I hoped we could be in the world into this framework. And so what the work is really trying to do, and I will say the Circle Way methodology in general, is really trying to bring an ancient way of being into a modern space. And the founders, Christina Baldwin and Linnea, had done a lot of work traveling the world and looking at different ways of being. And, circle practice as a whole has deeply, deeply indigenous roots. This is nothing new, right? Indigenous cultures from around the world have been practicing this way of being since time in memoriam. And the idea of, like, how do we recall that? How do we call back in the centering of humanity, the centering of relationships, this relational way of being? We have come so far from that, and we see that in our organizations. I was just sitting in on a webinar yesterday where they were talking about burnout and people just chronic stress levels that people are experiencing. It was contextualized in the United States, and my sense is that it's probably not super out of the question for other places in the world as well, right? Coming out of COVID. And so when we are thinking about the way that we've set up our organizations and our structures and our systems, they are not relational, right? They are not relationally based. If they were, we would not be seeing these epic numbers, these epic levels of inequities across all sectors. Relational ways of being means that we are in relationship. And when we are in relationship, our ability to kind of quote unquote other people, our ability to dehumanize other people or to not fully see each other's humanity is hindered. But if we are living in transactional spaces, which just says, you give me something, I give something to you, and it doesn't have to be the same thing, right? Then we are able to much more easily perpetuate inequities, to deepen them, and to not disrupt the systems that have been and continue to be incredibly oppressive.
That is so beautiful. That's like fundamentally the way we should be living. It's not something that should be brought in externally. And like you said, like indigenous people knew this, they know this, and this is what they have always practiced. Any indigenous book you read, they talk about holding hands, sitting in a circle. The circle is the most important thing because it goes around and everybody has a chance to sort of air out. And it's interesting that you say that because my mind is also going towards transformational justice, almost sort of like being able to kind of heal people that way, right? If someone has wronged you or you have wronged someone, this is your chance to kind of take advantage of the moment, so to speak, and speak out and to speak up. There are numerous ways that you could use something like this, right? What are some ways that you see that you use your cir the circle way in successfully, I guess.
Yeah, so I'll speak about the circle way in terms of just like integration into some of our smaller systems, so, such as organizations, right? And so, how do we transform systems or an organization that is coming in and it's like get to the agenda, business as usual? It's not to say that the work that we're doing is not important. It's very important. And I work a lot with nonprofit organizations who are very mission driven, doing really important work in the community. It's sort of like the how we're doing the work, right? And not just with the communities that we're serving, but with how we are engaging with one another. Are we creating, I mean, and this overlaps with so many different arenas, right? Psychological safety, trauma informed, right? How do we create spaces, places and conditions for building trust, for building transparency, for building safety, for building empowerment. And part of that is just down to the very nitty-gritty of like how we engage with one another. Are we bothering to do a little check-in at the beginning of our time together? Are we taking time to understand the greater context in which people are coming in? And this isn't to say we have to like come in with like all the details of our personal lives because there's safety. Part of the safety is allowing people to share what they need and want to. But it is helping us to slow down one of the key components that I have seen be transformational across the board with groups, organizations, when it comes to the Circle Way is the notion of the pause. So this is actually one of the circle agreements is calling pause when we need to sort of reset, we need to reflect, and we need to recall the purpose that we've gathered, right? And so this notion of pause is helping us to just slow down in a world that would have us speeding up and running into one another over and over and over again, right? And in this fast-paced world that we are existing in, this hurried, flurried pace, the notion of a pause is actually very revolutionary, right? And it doesn't mean we pause for an hour. We're pausing for like 10 seconds, 20 seconds, long enough to give our prefrontal cortex in moments where we might be very activated, time to sort of regroup and come back online, right? So we're not operating from an activated state. We can take a breath, maybe two or three. We can look around the room. We can remember where we are. If we have been activated and we're now back in some very traumatic experience, we can sort of have time to come back into the present and move forward in a more thoughtful, compassionate way for ourselves and for one another. So this is a little bit of a glimpse of where I've seen it be really effective. I think in terms of circle practices in general, the other area that there are slight variations and nuances in the type of circle practice that you're working with, but has been in holding spaces for healing for people and practitioners who are in the fields. I think this month I spent a lot of time with healthcare practitioners, everyone from administrators to physicians to nurses. There is, they are, I mean, and this is one particular specific population, right? But these are the people who have been tasked with healing our populations, right? With holding the sickness and the illness and the death and the dying and the grief. And where are they getting recharged? Where are they getting replenished, right? And so holding spaces for people to be able to come and just put down the armor for a few minutes, right? Where you're not having to hold, but you get to be held and heard. Makes a really, really big difference.
I love the notion of pause. I agree with you. It's revolutionary. I mean, we're so used to just go, go, go that even when we're talking, we're just reacting instead of listening. And I think the pause helps you listen and really hear the person, opposed to, responding right away. That's great. That's great. And I know that I need to pause too at times. So this is a great reminder for me to do that. So thank you. Thank you for that. So
Absolutely.
let's talk about the conflict consciousness workshop series. I'm sure there's a million different things you've learned from it, but what is like one learning that is the most important to you, and what is the purpose and aim of this series?
I love this question too. So I would say that the greatest learning, so all of the work that I do is sort of like I'm always self-experimenting first, right? I'm trying things out on myself, like what was really helpful to me in understanding my the ways that I show up in conflict. And so my greatest hope for people who go through this workshop series is that deepened awareness of themselves and the hows and whys of the ways that they show up in conflict. That's kind of the purpose, but it's also the intended outcome of like what I hope you'll get out of the series. So the premise is that if we are having a deepened awareness and understanding of how and why we show up in conflict the way that we do, we have greater agency over shifting that, right? We have greater agency over how we show up and shifting the ways that maybe were not serving us or maybe had served us at some point, but maybe more so from out of like a survival perspective to how do we show up in the ways that we want to show up? That might be more compassionate. That might be more constructive to actually navigating the conflict in a healthy way that is holding your humanity and my humanity and centering that. I think again, kind of going back to that through line of the work, and also that Albert Einstein quote, right? Like, if we have created this conflict, we cannot solve it from the same level of consciousness. So how do we shift that level of consciousness and raise it? We can only do that by doing that sort of introspective, reflective work on our own. So that is my hope and goal, is that we can create space and the conditions for people to show up more with more conflict consciousness in the world, and maybe. Just maybe we might have a different outcome than the one that we continue to have.
We can certainly hope for that. You've worked with groups to shift and share power. What does power shifting really mean? And do groups with privilege really succeed in shifting power?
I think that's an ongoing question. I think what I would say. When I think about power shifting, I really think about this as a shifting in our perspective about power and how we hold power and what we think about power. So if we're shifting from the like, I'm giving up or you're getting, like I'm giving up and you're getting, or you're giving up and I'm getting, it doesn't really necessarily give us a different perspective. It just changes the weight of the equation, right? And so when I think about power shifting, I'm really thinking about like, how do we shift from that give and get of the me to like what is really needed by the we, and how do we leverage power in a way that is in service and support of the whole and not just one person? I don't like not just rebalancing the equation, but just coming up with a completely new formula altogether. So I don't know. I think that it's an ongoing journey for folks who are, we all have privilege in different ways to like, again, sort of give up, but I'm more interested in like how do we just change the conversation to like putting power in service to what we need it to be serving, which is the whole.
Kind of makes me think of the circle way as a way to sort of help with that dynamic, right? If you're not looking to just transfer the power, then a better way is to collectively bring in the we to distribute the power equally, right? It's like that saying with the pie, we can cut the pie many different ways to make sure everybody gets a fair share. And so this kind of feels to me that it's applicable in that way. You're a woman of color, and you're engaged in conflict transformation work at this point. It's a very sort of volatile moment in time, if we were to speak. And I think every generation might think that their time is most volatile, but I really feels like very volatile at the moment. What is your take on that, and what is sort of your, what does it mean to you to be doing this work, particularly at this point in time?
For me, I think the first is acknowledging the privilege of having incredibly light skin, right? So I identify as a person of color in a body of culture, in a world that doesn't do well with nuance, in a society rather, that doesn't do super well with nuance. So acknowledging that privilege and then thinking about where I can leverage that to be able to get into spaces and have conversations that where other folks might not be able to get into or have access to. So I think that's one. I think the other is being really aware and in the places that I enter, how I navigate those places, knowing that I may be received in a number of different ways, right? So when I walk into a room, it's never obvious to me how I'm going to be perceived or received based off my identity, right? Because again, in a world of nuance, people are sort of like, I need to put you in a box. What box do I put you in? And not all of us fit cleanly into one box. And that's a good thing. I've come to learn over the years, it took a while to get there, but I'm happy I don't fit into a box. And I might even be okay with you being confused about, where you want to compartmentalize me, because our identities are incredibly complex and nuanced. And so I think thinking about wherever we are, whatever degree of privilege we have in society, how can we really help to shift that and leverage that, or not shift it, but leverage that in a way that allows us to do the important work of racial and social justice, do the important work of healing, and creating spaces that are rooted in relationship, and bringing that lens to spaces where that might be absent.
Yeah, because most of us have privilege. We may just not know what that privilege is. I mean, I identify as a woman of color and my box is very clear. But the one place that where I can mess around with my box is my name. Because when I first say my name or I write it in an email, people don't know if I'm a male or a female or something else, right? And so I think that your comment about the world doesn't do well with nuance is so spot on. Because when we don't understand something and it doesn't neatly fit into our definition of things, we want to immediately exclude it. Or we immediately want to label it something that's negative, that allows us to continue to put things in that box and move on, because that's how most people make sense of the world around them. But I think that by introducing some of these concepts that we've been talking about now, and just some of the work that you've been doing, I think people can become more comfortable with the idea of, I don't need to put people in boxes, or if this person goes into 10 different boxes, that's okay. That person can be that way. Here's how I'm going to utilize my privilege to the betterment of society. So I find that very interesting. And I think in some ways we can all sort of take so much out of it in our own respective, lives.
Thank you. And this is also so central to the specific like healing spaces, right? Like the healing spaces that we're holding, where we're inviting in story, and it's like we're not here to do anything with it. We're here to just listen. And that deep listening is like it can really put us into that much more reflective space rather than the fixing space of like, I'm hearing something that's really hard and I want to fix it, or you're sharing something about your identity and I want to understand where to put you. And it was like, and part of what we're inviting folks to do in those spaces is to just hold it. Just hold the complexity, the nuance. If you don't understand it right away, that's okay too.
It reminds me of a conversation I had a little while ago with another guest, and we were talking about decolonizing communication. And what you are talking to me now seems remarkably similar in terms of not decolonizing communication, but more decolonizing minds. Because we are so, again, not to beat a dead horse, but we're just so used to giving identities to people to make sense of the world. And I feel like that way doesn't work anymore, because we're living in worlds and communities and spaces that are so globalized. And there are so many people at once who belong to so many different backgrounds that the same, and with so many different experiences, right? Good or bad, that it's hard to kind of, and you shouldn't have to sort of box them in like that. So that was my first thought when you were sort of talking about that, that this seems more of sort of opening minds, and from the colonial way of thinking that has, given us all these problems in society today. And almost, at the same time, the whole part about listening, it's so transformative, I feel. Because we don't take the time to do it. We really don't. We listen to respond, like I was saying earlier. We don't listen to learn, or, sometimes people just need to talk. And your job in that moment is just to listen. And what I have learned with the few interviews and the few guests that I have been privileged enough to speak with is I take nuggets out of every conversation that I go into. And it might just be a one-liner, but it's transformative, right? Because it teaches me so much about the world and a way of thinking that I had not thought of before. So I really, really appreciate you kind of bringing this to the forefront, because as you can see today, I'm in the mood to talk a lot. But partly also because what you're saying resonates with me so much. So your talking is helping me sort of connect all of these dots, and I'm just feeling really great about
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad. Well, and
that.
vice versa, right? And this is part of what we are trying to, this is part of the work I'm trying to do is like, how do we create spaces for this type of engagement, right? Where it's like, I don't need to prove myself right. I don't need, you don't have to prove yourself. We're just here to learn from one another. And sometimes that act of just listening without being asked to respond prevents us from trying to defend ourselves, right? If you say something I disagree with, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to listen to you, right? I'm just going to hold it for now because this isn't a dialogue. This isn't a debate. I'm just doing some deep listening. And I'm going to take what you said, the thing that you said that I disagreed with, maybe, and I'm going to go and I'm going to think about it and reflect on it and realize that tomorrow I'm still okay, even though I disagreed with you. You know what I mean? I may have learned something about you. And in the course of listening, I might understand why you think what you think that I
Absolutely.
disagree with, right? And that's what we're really
Exactly.
trying to get to. I talk about like my number one principle in conflict transformation work is like, we are not striving for agreement, we're striving for understanding. Because if we understand one another, we will fundamentally come to the conversation with a different mindset. We will fundamentally come to the conversation with a different mindset. I don't have to agree with you to understand you. I can hold that nuance, but that's a muscle I have to build, right? That's a muscle we have to be able to build. Right now, for many of us, it's very, very, very like kind of weak or just not active. If we activate that muscle, we will get so much further, so much faster.
That's stunning. That is absolutely gorgeous. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Let's it's I feel like it's sort of a good transfer into my next question, which is about DE&I. So at this point in time, when DE&I has quickly become so tokenized in so many different contexts, right? What does the focus on justice and belonging bring into this space?
Well, I want to preface it by saying I am not an expert on this framework that I'm about to speak to, and I want to strongly encourage anyone listening to do some deep dives into it because it's a really profound framework. So I think that the Othering and Belonging framework that comes out of the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley has been a really profound one for me as I'm sort of observing and watching and experiencing this backlash of DEI, where our meaning like equity advocates, right? Like where our own language is being weaponized against us, and thinking about like what's the aerial view? That's almost always what I'm trying to get to. Like, what's the aerial view? The pure level view is like very, it's hard for us to get out of our own sort of like our own perspective. And if we can get to the aerial view, if we're not looking at like what you're doing to me or what I'm doing to you, but the aerial view is allowing us to see just like what is happening, right? Like, what are we observing happening? And I feel like the belonging framework gives us that aerial view of like, how do we create a world that is giving us something that we have not yet imagined? So DEI work has been incredibly important, has gotten us so far. And I think that I hear people refer to DEIB, right? The B being the belonging is sort of the all-encompassing framework. When we think about diversity, we're thinking about lots of different perspectives being in the room. When we think about inclusion, we're thinking about having all those different perspectives being included, but what are we including them in, right? We're still including them in something that's already pre-designed for us, right? So we're including in something that was pre-designed for us by specific people. And if we think about belonging, it's sort of like, how do we co-create something and have co-ownership over it, right? Something new altogether that's reflective of everyone. We're not trying to fit into a mold that was already created for us. And so I'm excited to continue that conversation of like, how do we really create that world of belonging that's meeting not just our basic human needs, but it's also creating a world that is completely within our reach. It just requires our imagination to help us get there.
I agree with that because I mean when I look at DE&I and you just look at it even from the corporate space or even just looking at the news of what recently happened at the different universities and so forth, it has become tokenized, but the framework is also extremely linear and there's no room for like it's like fitting a square peg into a round hole. There's no room for any sort of, transformation into that, right, structure. And so it's obvious that there has been an othering of people because there was no room for us, people like us, to begin with. So the people that it fit for, it fit well. But now that we are trying to sort of say, hey, this is not working, it suddenly becomes this issue. Right. And again, it brings to mind the earlier comment I made in terms of coming from a colonial mindset versus belonging coming from a decolonized mindset. It almost feels like you need that framework to sort of juxtapose on top of what we already have because it's not working the way the system is designed right now. I mean, it's working for the people it's meant to work for, but not for the rest of us. Who needed more than the others in some ways because of the othering that has happened over so many years and centuries of abuse and trauma. So
Absolutely.
it's refreshing to kind of hear that piece.
There is something else, right? And the thing is, like, I want to say DEI work has been so important. And our folks who have been on the front line since before DEI was a thing, right? Because there have been folks who have been doing this work for a long, 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 has been so incredibly important for setting the foundation for us to even be able to have a framework like belonging, right? It has helped us get to where we are. And if we are really thinking about living into that beautiful vision of the beloved community that Dr. King talked about, like belonging is what's going to help us get there. And so I'm really, really encouraged by that framework. And there was this powerful conference that just happened in Oakland, California, literally last week. It was called Belonging Without Othering, and this was through the OBI, Othering and Belonging Institute had put it on. And it was just so powerful to come together and just really think about, dream and imagine a world where belonging is our framework and our guiding post.
Yeah, that's like I said, I think I've used the word transformative many times in this conversation with you today, but I do really believe that and if you read any native text, any text from indigenous people, the first people, this is all there. It's all there. It's not anything that has been, invented recently. And if you look at the work of people, you mentioned people on the front lines, if you women of color who've been on the front lines, Black, Brown, Indigenous women who've been on the front lines, they've talked about this forever, right? They've seen this in action and they've implemented this and they know this works. So it's there is no we don't need to go back to the drawing board and look for anything. It's just we have to really take what these folks have been telling us for so long is working and implement that. So it's so much of it is just going back to the basics and listening to the people on the front line. And it's remarkably easy in some ways and remarkably difficult in many, many others.
Absolutely. I think that's so well said. It is remarkably easy in some ways and remarkably different. I mean, difficult in other ways. This is really about the recalling, right? Recalling who we really are, right? When we were born, so Dr. John Powell talks about this, and I love this. He opens so many of his presentations with like the foundation of our connectedness. We are literally born connected to another human being. Right? Like there is a physical connection to another human being. No one is born without that. And that is so powerful to me, right? And if we can remember that, like our interconnectedness, again, indigenous wisdom that's been around for since time immemorial, right? Like we are, everything is connected. And so the notion of belonging isn't just about creating human societies, it's also about creating societies with the creating a sense of a society of belonging that incorporates the earth because we are of the earth, right? And so, how do we create that relationship in a way that centers health and healing for everyone, including the planet that we live with?
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I mean, there's a whole level of simplicity in it that grounds you and just sort of makes you realize that it's really not as complicated as you're making it out to be. And life is just so much more about connection. But somehow we run after, all the other things. And in the process, we live very lonely lives that are devoid of human touch and the human connection that we so desperately need to survive. So all of this conversation is really powerful in that sense because it reminds you to just go ground yourself. I was reading this indigenous text and they were talking about, the drum that is used in many indigenous cultures and not just here, even, in North America. You go to Africa, go to India, indigenous communities. I'm sure in other parts of the world they use the drum. And they said the drum is the heartbeat of Mother Earth. And it's so beautiful, right? Like, if you just take a moment to reflect on those words, there can't be anything more beautiful than that. And that's what brings us all together when we hear that heartbeat and we are forced to, even if you're not a dancer, somehow your feet pick up and you start moving. And that's a testament to the beauty of the planet and the beauty of Mother Earth. So it feels so, amazing to kind of go down that path and to start thinking about those things, because then you just realize the value of other things that you've given so much to really is not worth so much.
100%. And I think what you're speaking to is so beautiful because it's like our bodies know, right? When you're like, my body's moving and I'm not
Exactly.
even giving it permission, but I see my shoulders moving or my hips swaying, like, or
Right.
my foot tapping, like the body knows, the body's responding, right? If we
Yeah.
can just quiet the mind, we can quiet the mind long enough to allow the body's wisdom to come forth, it will tell us everything we need to know.
The body remembers,
Yep, the body remembers.
Remembers. Well, that's beautiful. All right. Let's move on. I touched a little bit on this earlier, but I want to talk about adversarial justice and how it is the norm today. And we see a massively unhealed society. It's operating and replicating the very violence that it vowed it never let to happen. And I think it goes without saying that, what's happening in Gaza right now is just that, right? And you look at Germany and you say, well, we'll never let the Holocaust happen again, but here we are witnessing another Holocaust, and Germany again is on the wrong side of the equation. But in this process, they're not even noticing the violence, right? Like, that's the worst part of the situation, is that they're noticing it, but they don't give it the same import that it really deserves. So what are alternative approaches? And I think we talked a little bit about the circle way, but what are other approaches that you can use and shift away from punishment towards more, towards healing, not just the person who's been wrong, but even the person who committed the crime, because there has to, no sane person just wants to go and harm. Like, there is a level of hurt in, the person committing the crime as well. So how do you kind of use, healing in that sort of way?
I think this is one of the most important questions that we need to be asking ourselves as a society right now, because our system of quote unquote justice is so heavily rooted in punitive approaches that are causing so much more harm and trauma than they are attempting to help. So I am not a restorative justice practitioner, but I do think restorative justice is one of the key ways that we're going to think differently about how we hold each other accountable. And I know that transformational justice is sort of the next era of that work, right? So not just about how do we help restore healing, how do we create spaces for people to come to access healing even in the face of the most horrific thing that could have happened. The question beyond that too is like, how do we repair and how do we address the system that's allowed for that to happen, right? Because to your good point, people aren't just born and then, decide that they're gonna go cause harm or, go commit a crime with someone. There are a whole lot of series of events that lead someone to do something like that, right? So we're holding in restorative justice, like we're sort of holding the person who's caused the harm accountable in a way that's allowing everyone to heal, not just the person who was impacted, but also the person who did the who committed the harm. But then we also like if we don't also address a system in which those this has happened, then we just allow other similar situations to continue to happen. And so I think about like if we just put someone away, we lock them away, we throw away the key, and then eventually that person comes back into society. Whatever trauma they carried with them into incarceration, because we can guess probably 9.9 times out of 10, whoever's caused that harm has already been harmed. They've now gone into a system that is tremendously, exponentially causing more harm to them. And then we're sending them back into society. And then when they end up back in incarceration, we're saying like, see, they weren't able, we they were a bad apple to begin with, right? So we're punishing the person, not the system. We're not looking at the systems and the conditions and the environment that created the harm that led to this person doing whatever they did. So there's just like a bigger picture that I think we need to hold. And again, in a society where it's so much easier to find a person, like a position to blame, rather than trying to understand the bigger context. And the story is the bigger context. Do we know this person's story? And this isn't to say, this is by no stretch of the imagination, let me be very clear, meant to condone someone causing harm, right? This is never meant to condone it. It is just meant to help us have a different lens about how we hold one another accountable in a way that doesn't replicate the very thing that we say that we're trying to address or trying to fight.
No, I completely get your point. It's not about condoning the behavior, but it's about giving yourself perspective, right? As a society, to try to understand, okay, I can now understand the reason. And that doesn't mean you understand the reason, you excuse the behavior, but at least now you understand the reason and you have a way to potentially help the person to not commit the crime again. Because like you said, if that cycle keeps repeating, then you're just going to end up saying, this is a bad apple, forget it, let's move on. Where the situation could be completely resolvable had you taken the time to do it. And I think this is a very important conversation. I agree with you. This is one of the biggest questions we should be asking, because as a one of the superpowers, I guess, or the superpower in the world, however they like to call themselves, we have the largest amount of people incarcerated in the world today. Most of them being Black and Brown and Indigenous people. So you
By design.
cannot, by design,
By
exactly,
design.
you cannot lock away all these people for a better part of their life, in some cases, most of their lives, for crimes that are, addressable, and attributed to a system that was designed to fail them from the beginning. So it's almost like these things are connected, right? They all come to this junction together. But somehow we only look at that one artery in the entire system and say we need to cut this artery off in order to improve the system. Meanwhile, the system's doing what the system was designed to do. And what when you were talking about that, the other point that came to me is harm against the environment, right? And how almost never is that a crime, right? And in context with our conversation in the previous, your answer, the previous question I asked you, and we're talking about the drumbeat and all of that, it just seems like this is not meeting, this is the one place that restores us, heals us, transforms us, makes sure we survive, and we commit crimes against Earth. And hey, it's okay.
It's a heavy reality to sit with, right? Again, going back to that aerial view, if we sort of like zoomed way out and now we're kind of looking at the planet and humanity and the interaction between the two from a completely kind of like just a observational standpoint, and we see the species of humans destroying the very habitat that houses them, it's kind of this like interesting, like what would we say if we were observing that on a smaller scale? We would think like, this is so interesting. Just humanity understand that it's literally destroying its own habitat. What is going on here that's allowing for that? So here's back to the relational piece, right? Like the deep disconnection we have to have from our own humanity to allow for the horrific acts that are happening in the world right at this very moment that we're having this conversation. There's a deep disconnection from our own humanity, and there's layers and degrees of that, right? If you are like front and center of othering someone to the point where you are murdering them, the disconnection is vast, right? If you are aware but not necessarily in that space, there is still a disconnection that's happening from our own humanity. So now we take that and put that in the context of our relation. That's our relationship with one another. We take that and put that in the context of our relationship with the planet, our relationship with animals, right? Like all our relations from the, again, from the native wisdom of like everything is connected. We are committing like in full truthfulness, like we're really doing this to ourselves, right? So when I harm you, I'm harming me. When you harm me, you're harming yourself. There is a reciprocity there that is so important for us to remember and so easy for us to forget because of the way that we've been conditioned and socialized. So this notion of like the disconnect, like who's standing up for the planet? Yes, we have a lot of climate justice advocates out there. We should all be climate justice advocates, right? We should all be earth advocates because the earth is part of who we are. But if we are conditioned and taught to feel disconnected from, we live on the earth as opposed to live with the earth. We are able to do things that are egregious without holding that level of guilt, right? Because we see it as separate from ourselves when it really is part of who we are.
But it's also, I understand and agree with everything you said. And my understanding of it is that it's also all connected. So not just that we are in connection with each other and with the planet, but the issues are also connected. So if you take at, let's look at just the environment, which is I consider to be sort of like the mother of all issues right now, because it is. But you look at immigration. It comes from the environment. It comes because there are places in the world where there's not enough water to drink, or there's not enough land to cultivate on. You've poisoned the earth so much that people have no choice but to move. So that's related. You look at, incarceration. Some people may be doing, looting or stealing or what have you, because they don't have enough opportunities, because there haven't been, the system again has designed in a way that it's not beneficial to them. So for me, it's like all of these issues are, coming out of each other. They're not. So there is a connection with us, but there's also a connection with that. So you can't look at something in isolation. Right? Like when you go to the doctor, and this is one of the things about modern medicine is great, science is wonderful, there's been a lot of progress, but there's still so many blind spots. Like my daughter had an issue with her knee, and we took her to the doctor, and the doctor only looks at the knee. How can you only look at the knee? You have to look at the ankle, you have to look at the hip, you have to look at the entire leg. So it's kind of like that same thing that we can say with society, right? We're only looking at the knee, ignoring the ankle, the foot, and the hip when they all come together to form the leg. So
Absolutely.
it's just baffling that I guess people know, but they don't want to admit it because then the system will work against them. What do you think is the reason why we kind of have this bird's eye, like just centered in on these?
Rupande, how much time do you have? That's like a whole like episode part two or something.
Maybe we should we maybe I should just have you like talk about that the next time. Just
I
talk to me
mean,
about this.
I that's so huge, right? Like, what gets in our way? I think that's the million-dollar question, right? So we are a world with brilliant, brilliant people in it. We are not a world without solutions. Here's the thing. I'm always not telling people, like, we're like, oh, these big issues. I'm like, they're not without solutions. There are solutions out there. So what is getting in our way? Is it like, is it a values? Like, is it a value proposition? Like, what we say we value is not actually what we value. Do we have competing commitments, right? I say I really care about the earth, but I'm more committed to X, Y, and Z, right? That is contradiction. It is a contradiction to that commitment. I mean, I think it's such a, I would love to dive into that conversation because we are not without solution. I love John Powell said, the only reason we can't create a world of belonging is a lack of imagination, right? And I was like, wow, well, that's powerful too.
That's part of it, though, right? Like, that is part of it.
It could be,
But
yeah.
is it capitalism? Is that what, like, stops us from looking at any viable solution that will reduce the money that people make?
I think that it's kind of like what we've been talking about. I think it's like complex and nuanced. And I think that there is probably, if we drill down like with the whys, like, but why is that? Why is that? We would get down to some sort of fundamental, I don't know if I want to say truth, but I think there'd be some sort of fundamental reason that's getting in our way of that. And I don't know if it's a lack of imagination or a inability to really do what's necessary. I like to believe I still have faith in humanity. I have a lot of faith in humanity that faced with the like quote unquote way like right thing to do, like the thing that's gonna help everyone, we would do it. We saw a lot of that happen during COVID of people stepping up and stepping in for one another. Although we didn't see that very much on the news. It was much more we were much more saturated with the gloom and doom and how humanity's tearing itself apart as opposed to like the people who were actually doing the wellness checks and helping one another out. So I still have a lot of faith that humanity has that in us. We have that in us. I don't know that I have a concrete answer. I think it's just a really good question to dive into.
Maybe it's a good question for the Circle Way
Yeah, we could definitely
to
have
come
some.
together and talk about that. Maybe that's something we should talk about. Rangina, you've been so generous with your time, and I didn't even realize we've spent so much time talking. It's been such a pleasant and, just beautiful conversation with you. So let me ask you my last question that I ask all my guests, and that is, what are three resources to learn more about your work?
So I would definitely thank you for asking that, and thank you so much for having me on this special podcast. It has been my complete pleasure getting to have this conversation with you today. So three resources, definitely my website, Soul Resolutions International, is a great place to start. I'm trying to be better about being active on LinkedIn and gosh, well, my website has lots of different places you can learn more about my work and about me. And so I will probably just leave it at those two. But yeah. And anytime anyone wants to reach out, I always welcome a conversation too.
Well, thank you. This has been a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for being so generous with all this information you shared. And you've definitely given me so much to think about. So I'm very grateful for that.
Well, the gratitude is 1,000% mutual. And thank you for asking such amazing, thoughtful, insightful questions.
Thank you for listening to us today. Feel free to subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Instagram at Radio InCollab. Until next time, Abjo.